So last week, we finished chapter 1, Job chapter 1. We looked at verse 6 to 22, and we saw the first two scenes of the narrative, the beginning of the end, the beginning, the end of the beginning, the narrative at the start of Job. We saw the end of it, but it's at the beginning of Job. I'm confused. Thank you. We saw scene one in heaven behind the curtain. We saw scene two, the initial testing where the great man Job is no longer great, no longer the greatest man of all the East, but the poorest man of all the East. Tonight, we turn to all of chapter two, where we see the third and fourth scenes play out. And again, just as one and two have showed us, we begin in heaven and we finish on earth. So let's start there. Chapter 2, verse 1 to 6, scene 3 in heaven. This is what Job 2 has to say for us. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand, only spare his life." In verse 1, to the beginning part of verse 3, we see the exact same details that were given to us as we saw in chapter 1, verse 6 to 8. No time reference is once again given to let us know how much time has gone between the events of chapter 1 and how much time is now gone between this beginning and chapter 2. We're simply told of another heavenly court meeting or divine council on another day, where the angelic host comes to present themselves before God. And Satan, again, is present at this meeting just as before, and God's words to him are the same as last time. "From where have you come?" The answer is also the same, maneuvering out from underneath the question like a disobedient teenager. "From going to and fro on the earth and walking up and down on it." And of course we know that this is trying to get out from under the thumb of God's question, because we know what Satan has been up to. He's been doing a lot more than what he's just said. We saw what he did in chapter 1 with Job, and he doesn't even say it. God, knowing this full well, responds again with the exact same recommendation in verse 3, as he did back in chapter 1, verse 8. "Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." Notice, three times now, in the first two chapters, we have read of the same characteristics and quality of the man Job. Once from the author, and twice from God himself. This repetition is purposeful, intentionally purposeful, to get it cemented into us as readers who Job is. Because, as we dip into, Lord willing, next Sunday evening, the long, middle, confusing section where this very thing is called into question, we easily forget who Job is and start to believe the friends. But notice, as verse 3 ends, there is more added that was not there previously. God says, Job still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. In this little addition, God reminds Satan of two things. First, that in spite of all of his best efforts, Job is still a godly man, and even though that remains, even though he is no longer a great man. And second, that his destructive motive toward Job was illogical, unreasonable, and undeserved. This statement from God concerning Job's true malicious intentions is the Old Testament equivalent of Jesus' indictment of the thieves and robbers in his day in John chapter 10, verse 10. The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. Of course, many people attribute that directly to Satan when we read that, and we should, but first and foremost, we have to remember that in the context, this does not this is not talking about Satan directly. This is talking about the thieves and robbers who try to sneak in the pen and attack the sheep in other ways rather than coming in through the door. Remember, because he is the great shepherd of the sheep. Satan responds in an angry outburst in verse 4 and 5. And we have to remember as we are reading punctuation. Is it skin for skin? No. Job in his fury, there's an exclamation mark. This is true for English. This is also true in Hebrew. There are their own little grammatical points to add emphasis here. Job is furious, and so he responds to God, skin for skin! Did I say the other thing? Sorry. Satan responds.
He's hanging around me too. That's got to be it, Almond.
Thank you.
I give him that short-term stuff. Job, Satan.
Satan responds in an angry outburst. Skin for skin. All that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. And we get this. I mean, Satan is angry. His prior attempts at accusing and maligning and ruining and destroying Job's supposed godliness and defaming God's glory publicly have failed miserably. We can even say that Satan is aware, even after attempt number one, that his failed attempt has had the opposite effect that he intended. He wanted the glory of God to be defamed, but because of his first attempt, the glory of God is now made more much of in Job's life. And we readers recognize this. And so having lost round one, he goes into round two, swinging to destroy. Not by just attacking what Job has, but by attacking who Job is himself in his person. And I think the distinction being made here that we too often forget in our current cultural setting, Satan understands that there's a difference between what a man is and what a man has. In our day, we tend to define the man by what he has rather than what he is. Job understands it at the core. Satan understands it at the core of Job's heart. There is an individual that is more than the possessions speak for. And this is now what he aims at. So getting the surface things out of the way, Satan now puts his aim at the core of this individual. And so you attack someone with what they have, and they may get angry, depressed, and sorrowful, but you attack who the person is in their health, in their body, in their soul, and they will be brought, Satan thinks, Job will be brought to the deepest levels of misery and sorrow. After his initial attempt failed, this is what Satan wants, to expose Job for the fraud that he is. And in verse 6, God gives it to him, and he gives him permission once again. The doomed sentence, "Behold, he is in your hands. Only spare his life." So again, we see that Satan can only do what God allows him to do and can go no further, being the dog on a chain that he is. And I wonder if you think, as I thought, and as many people think at this point, when we see God give this permission to attack Job once again, but this time at the core of who he is, trying to bring him down to the lowest point possible, we think already Job has suffered more than any individual in history in one day. No one has suffered like this man. Two terror attacks from the Sabaeans and the Chaldeans, and two natural disasters in one day. Yet, even though we may cry enough, and that Job is now the least of all men in the East, God allows more suffering to come Job's way. We should conclude that God is doing this because he really wants it to be known publicly that his glory is more important than our comfort. It really is more important than our comfort. He wants that to be publicly seen beyond a shadow of a doubt, that he is worthy of worship apart from anything that he gives to us. And so Job will serve the purpose of God's glory. And so will Satan through the suffering. And so that's scene 3. As we go into scene 4, we come down from heaven to earth. We look at verse 7 to 10 at this being carried out. Verse 7 to 10. "So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And Job took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes." And this is where we get the one instance of Job's wife. "Then his wife said to him, 'Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die.' But Job said to her, 'You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips." Again, there is no time reference. As we saw in scene 1 and 2, there was a day and there was a day. But here it's a little bit different. Do you notice the formula is not exactly followed again? We're not sure of how much time took place, but notice what's not repeated this time. As we move from transition to scene 1 to 2, there's another transition moment. There was a day. As we move from 3 to 4, there is no repetition of "now there was a day." It seems to be in verse 7 that Satan, in his furious rage, immediately leaves the presence of God to carry out his next attack on Job. This shows us something of his fury, of his indignance at God, ruining his prior attempt. And so he carries out his second attempt immediately. He leaves the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores. Notice also that while last time all of Job's suffering in chapter 1 was through what we would call a secondary cause, the Sabaeans, the Chaldeans, lightning, and gale force winds. One commentator called it a hurricane. This time, there is no secondary cause. There is a personal attack. Who was it that struck Job? Satan struck Job. Personally, intimately, from the sole of his feet to the top of his head, he's got loathsome sores. The entirety of his physical health is now taken from him. It's interesting, I found it humorous. I looked up the word loathsome in Hebrew as it comes over into the English, and the only other translation that I found in all the books on the shelf were disagreeable sores. I was like, of course they're going to be disagreeable if they're loathsome. That is the far better word here in view than just disagreeable sores. But as bad as this scene is, you can imagine him sitting there. For those of you who, I know my older sister is like this, and she will not like me sharing this with you, but it's a funny brother-sister thing. She likes scabs, and she likes picking them. She cannot stay away from picking scabs. I know it's gross. I think it's gross too. She does this, but she can't keep away from them. These are not what's in view when loathsome sores come into view in verse 7. Job broke a pot and is now scraping his entire body. This is disgusting. Henry cannot solve this for Job with anything in the pharmacy. Nope. Here's a pot. You break it and scrape. Those are the instructions until they go away. So as bad as this scene is, it then gets worse in verse 9. Satan's personal attack is over, and while the effect of the itch, perhaps the monumental, constant, nagging itch from head to toe lingers, we see another attack, and it is from his beloved. The only time we meet her, the entire book, is here in verse 9 and 10. We questioned about her motives the very first night we were lingering in Job, and I want to still say that her comment here to her husband is deplorable, but withhold, as hard as you may have to, withhold judgment on her. Grief truly does hit people in very different ways. But one thing that is common in all of grief is that at some stage, anger is always present. And so when we see her in verse 9, it seems that we have met her in the midst of angry grief. And her deplorable counsel: do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. This counsel is so awful, it prompted St. Augustine to label Job's wife as Satan's tool. It prompted Calvin to call her the devil's assistant, because she was asking Job to do the very thing that Satan wanted Job to do: to curse God and die. But even though she is his wife, Job responds in correction, calmly I think, and graciously, maybe not calmly, but graciously for sure. He says this, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God and shall we not receive evil?" He doesn't call her a fool, but he says the way that you're talking is like the rest of the foolish women talk. This is not like you. Put that away. So he's calling her foolish in a roundabout way, saying you're talking like a fool. I know you're not, and I don't believe you to be a fool, but you're speaking like a fool. And then he says something that many people find loathsome and disagreeable. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? This is rhetorical, by the way, because the answer is immediately known. Of course we ought to receive both. If we're so eager to receive one, why are we not eager to receive the other? Obviously, one's painful and one is not, but both are from the hand of our Heavenly Father. Shall we reject one while embracing the other? Of course not! I find it interesting that while many today would disagree with Job's words here, saying evil does not come to us from God's hand, but rather from free will or some kind of chance, verse 10 confirms that what Job said is not wrong. In all this, he did not sin with his lips. This does not only refer to the theology that he's putting forth there in verse 9, but it refers to everything that he has done on this day of second testing, of round 2 with Satan. He has passed trial number 2, and now it is publicly known in us that there is a man who worships God simply for God and not for any of the blessings he can get or have received from this God. Speaking of verse 10, we cleverly try to protect ourselves from things that would do us eternal good, I think. And part of that is rejecting true doctrine. Everything whatsoever comes to pass comes from the hand of God. If we do not believe this, then we must conclude that suffering that comes into our life is meaningless. That it is random, that it is by chance, and that God did not intend these things to happen, that it's just a consequence of free will and suffering in the world that he said oops about. And so again, in Job 2 here, it puts forth the doctrine of God's independent sovereignty, that he is king, and that nothing in the kingdom that he has made takes him by surprise. Do not fight against this. You will want to, and you will talk to many people who will say that this is not the God that I worship. And you say, well, that's not the God. That's the God that Job worshiped. Do you worship someone else? Be an appropriate but probably not gracious response. Before we move on to the friends, let me just say this. These first two chapters of Job are scary, and they are terrible. We talked about, and I posed the question, do you really believe that the glory of God is more important than our comfort? And we all said a resounding yes. But as we've seen Job chapter 1 and Job chapter 2 unfold, going from the greatest man of the East plunging from riches to destitution because of God's permission? I think that a proper reaction to seeing these things is a fear that Job's story may become our story. Are you thinking that? I think it's a normal response to this text. We are at some level wondering, if God did this for him, would he do it for me? And so, we need to be reminded. No human has suffered like this. Job's suffering is extreme and very rare, even in the most tragic of cases. I'd even say his extreme suffering is intentionally rare. Why? Because it points to a deeper reality that we would one day see in another innocent sufferer. Christopher Ashe, in his commentary, says it like this: Job in his extremity is actually a shadow of a reality more extreme still, of a man who was not just blameless, but sinless, who is not just the greatest man in a region, but the greatest human being in history, greater even than merely human, who emptied himself of all his glory, became flesh, and went all the way down to a degrading, naked, shameful death on the cross, whose journey took him from eternal fellowship with the Father to utter aloneness on the cross. The story of Job is a shadow of the greater story of Jesus Christ. And so we conclude this section, before we get to 11 through 13, by saying that even in our day after the cross, Satan really can still attack us. He still can attack us, but because of the cross, his accusations are no longer unanswered, as they were for Job. No one stood in the gap between God, Job, and Satan. No one spoke up in his defense. We cannot say such things are true of us any longer. We have an advocate. We have a defense attorney who, when we are accused, speaks for us and puts his blood on display and says, yes, he, she is a sinner, ruined in their sin, but my blood has changed their heart. And they are now free and forgiven, regardless of whatever you say. Satan may have been allowed to enter these heavenly councils, but he is no longer allowed because Christ rules and reigns on the throne. And sin still may have a grip and power on us, but now because of the cross, because Christ put Satan and all of his so-called authority to public shame, the only sin that we struggle with is canceled sin. It's a wonderful line if you've ever sung that hymn, "Oh for a Thousand Tongues," you ever paid attention. Of course, I can't think of the lyric right now. He breaks the power of canceled sin. His blood sets the prisoner free. It availed for the foul like me. And so the only foe that we reckon with today is a defeated foe. And in all of our suffering, in all of our sin, in all of our temptation, we must remember this. And so we think of John Piper, what he said in his famous statement, "Satan can only gum you. His fangs have been taken out. His gums can kill you, but they can only send you to heaven. He can no longer damn anyone. That has been covered by the blood." So these things we need to remember, and they're put straight up in front in verse 7 to 10. But let's end by seeing the friends enter in verse 11 to 13. Before the poetic interchange begins between Job and his friends, the narrative of chapter 1 and 2 ends with an introduction to those friends in verse 11 to 13. This is what it says. Now, when Job's three friends heard, think of the time in this day and age it would have taken for them to hear. When they heard of all this evil that had come upon them, they each came from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. They made an appointment together to come to show him sympathy and comfort him. And when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him, and they raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. It must have taken some time for word to reach these three friends of Job, but when word reached them, they came to leave. And it must have taken time for them to get there. And so a long time has passed from the time that Job's suffering has happened to when they heard and when they finally got there. But when they hear of it, like I said, they come. They're from the great cities of the east, Teman, Shua, and Naamah. The way that these cities, not all of them are spoken of in the rest of Scripture, but I believe two of the three are. When the Scriptures talk about these cities, it leads us to believe that in this time and that culture, these cities were the creme de la creme, the place to be if you wanted wisdom and deep learning. And so, as we see these three men, supposedly they're friends with Job, so they are probably also similarly great men of their cities, we see the wisdom of the world come to Job. And therefore, we have a question. Can the world, in all its wisdom, give the innocent, godly sufferer help in the time of grief? Or will the wisdom of the world be shown to be foolish? No doubt, many of you have probably heard in a sermon on Job or a thought on Job, it's often said that the best thing these friends did was sit and be silent with Job. I propose to you that this is not the case. Though it was probably good at first, they were silent way too long. I believe this because in 1 Samuel 31:13, we see a death after the war had ended. David is grieving Jonathan. How long does he grieve? 7 days for a death. 7 days for a death. Job is still alive. Yet they are silent 7 days. It's as if his friends believe that Job has died and that he is just a shell of a man. This is probably why their initial reaction was so emotional. They didn't recognize their friend. It's as if he had died. And so my conclusion is that their silence began helpful, but it remained and lingered because accusations toward him, I think, extended the silence a bit longer than it should have. So, that's a matter of debate. You don't have to agree with me there, but I would put that forth with you that that is what's going on. So what do we do with this? What are we to make of his friend's presence if their presence is a bad one from the beginning? Interesting. Reading widely can help at sometimes. The French Roman Catholic commentator Jean Danielou. Probably butchered that, but this is what he said. Suffering encloses a man in solitude. Between Job and his friends, an abyss was cleft. They regarded Job with astonishment as a strange being, and they could no longer get to him. Only Jesus can cross this abyss, descend into the pit of misery, and plunge into the deepest hell. And we think, man, I mean, we know he's Roman Catholic, but that is a good statement. That is a good statement. Only Jesus can cross this divide that this suffering has incurred with Job. His friends cannot get to him. They realize this. And so we are left with a realistic view of life. It can sometimes be dreadfully hard and lonely, but we're also left with a realistic view of gospel hope. Job's sufferings and isolation are only a taste of what Jesus Christ suffered for us. And because of his greater suffering, we can have hope in our own that no pain is too great, no grief can take us far enough, and no pit is too deep or black that Christ cannot bring life and light into such sorrow and despair. And that's where we're left. As the initial narrative in Job's 42 chapters ends, and as chapter 3 begins, poetry begins. And it is poetry of despair right off the bat in chapter 3. As Job laments the day of his birth, perhaps confirming to his friends that he wishes he were dead. But we'll get there. Don't want to get too far ahead.